Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie Wilkinson, and today's podcast is going to provide a brief primer to ADHD. Now, the reason I decided to do that with today's podcast is because rolling out very soon will be a workshop course that will be provided all online for parents of children with ADHD. Now, the hopes is that parents of children with ADHD will be able to watch the course material, the different lessons. There's going to be about 20 or 21 lessons, and we may even add more as time goes by. But the lessons are going to provide a little bit of background and information about what ADHD is, what it's not, how we treat ADHD, what to expect at different developmental stages, and then, but then the bulk of the course is going to focus on behavioral strategies, things that parents can do in the home on a day-to-day basis to help with ADHD symptoms. So today's podcast is going to be a primer to that. This is also going to be our first real video podcast. It's going to be released on iTunes as just the audio, but we will have the video portion of it along with some slides and stuff available on YouTube. So if you're listening to it on a podcast feed, you know, check us out on YouTube at Paedeia, P-A-E-D-E-I-A. That's our channel. And we will have this posted as the Mental Breakdown podcast number 70, ADHD, a primer. Okay, so we're going to have another video coming out later that's going to go into much more detail about what ADHD has been over the years. And the reason that I'm saying it that way is because that since its inception, or since it was first described way, way back in history, ADHD has evolved. Its name has changed. It was previously referred to as things like minimal brain dysfunction. It was previously considered an encephalopathy, which means that they actually thought that it was, you know, due to swelling in the brain actual physical damage from different activities and illnesses and things like that. So we've evolved as our, I guess I shouldn't say evolved, our understanding of ADHD has changed over time as we have learned more about what's going on in the brain and what's going on inside people with ADHD and ADHD symptoms. So as we learn more, it will continue to change. There, of course, are people out doing research to look at various genes that could be evaluated or identified as a precursor or a genetic predisposition for the manifestation of ADHD. We're not quite there yet, but they are certainly working in that direction. Now, one of the things that I always like to mention when talking about sort of the basic principles of ADHD is to differentiate or talk about the differentiation between ADHD and ADD. Now, a lot of people will come into the office and we'll meet with professionals as well as parents, and they will work and even correct us to differentiate between ADD and ADHD. And so I always like to start with that as a jumping board. The reality is that there's no difference between the two. The title, the name is different because they come from different books. Otherwise, they're exactly the same thing. ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, is the name given by the American Psychiatric Association in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. Now, the most recent edition is the fifth edition, but generally speaking, ADHD, as defined by the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, by the DSM, is pretty much similar or almost exactly the same, except for a couple of changes that I'll mention in a moment, but from what it was in the previous editions. The ADD diagnosis comes from the International Classification of Diseases, the ICD-10, is from the World Health Organization, and that is the diagnostic manual primarily used by primary care physicians, general practitioners, specialists that are not psychiatric-based. Psychiatric and neurological based. And a lot of times neurologists will use the DSM as well. But except for psychiatrists and neurologists, almost all other physicians use the International Classification of Diseases. And in the ICD, ADHD, or what we know as ADHD by the DSM, is called ADD, attention deficit disorder. And what those do is you have ADD, attention deficit disorder, but if it's also complicated with the hyperactivity symptoms, then it would be called ADDH, attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity. Now, from a diagnostic perspective, they're exactly the same. The way that we differentiate is from the source. If it's the ICD, it would be ADD or ADDH. And if it's from the DSM, it would be ADHD. Now, what happens is people will say, well, but you can't call him ADHD if he doesn't have hyperactivity. Well, that's true. But the APA has a way around that, a way to that they have addressed that, because ADHD, according to the American Psychiatric Association, has three subtypes. The ADHD predominantly inattentive type, which means that there is no hyperactivity, or at least not enough hyperactive symptoms to qualify for that type. So you have ADHD predominantly inattentive type. You have ADHD predominantly hyperactive impulsive type. And that's a unique subset of children and adults with ADHD who have the hyperactive impulsive symptoms, but they're really not that inattentive. And we see that in children, not very often, but what happens is those are the kids who are bouncing off the walls and they're doing all these hyperactive and impulsive behaviors. But yet when you say, hey, what did I just say? And they can repeat it back verbatim. They attend, they know what's going on, they can hear you, they're for lack of a better word, paying attention, but their hyperactivity and impulsivity doesn't allow them to sit still and to remain in their seat and to sort of meet those other behavioral expectations. The third subtype from the DSM is the ADHD combined type, and that means that the person has both inattentive symptoms as well as hyperactive impulsive symptoms. So arguably, the DSM is a little bit more comprehensive because it offers it identifies the three subtypes, whereas the World Health Organization manual, the ICD, only has really the two, the ADD and the ADDH. So, but that's really the only difference. So when somebody comes in and they say, oh no, my kid doesn't have ADHD, he has ADD, they're really exactly the same thing. It's not, there's not really much of a difference, except for where the source comes from. Typically speaking, if a person comes in with a diagnosis of ADD and they say, my physician diagnosed me with ADD, then usually it's a primary care physician or a pediatrician, and that's how I'll sort of have the idea of where the diagnosis was made, typically. Not always, but typically. So with that sort of out there, you can see that the symptoms of ADHD fall within two broad categories. Inattentive symptoms, which include things like not paying attention to details, losing things that you need on a daily basis, being forgetful, having difficulty with sustained attention. Usually individuals with ADHD, with the inattentive symptoms, they have a hard time engaging in activities that require lots of concentration, lots of focus. For kids, that certainly is homework and even classwork. It includes reading and those kinds of things. Whereas adults with this inattentive type, they tend to, again, avoid tasks that require lots of attention. Sometimes that includes balancing checkbooks and doing paperwork and you know, tedious tasks that require a lot of focus and attention. For the hyperactive impulsive type, we've already kind of talked a little bit about it, but those are symptoms where you have difficulty sitting still, maybe bouncing your legs or somewhat fidgety, intruding or interrupting other people, having a difficult time allowing someone to finish what they're saying before you start to answer, and those kinds of behaviors that we can see that are sort of the stereotypic behaviors associated with ADHD from what we've thought about from times past. Now, to be diagnosed with ADHD, there are a couple of really important pieces. And the first is you have to have had symptoms prior to the age of 7. Now, 7 is what the DSM-4 required for a diagnosis of ADHD. Now, when the DSM-5 came out a couple of years ago, that began to shift things. And now, currently, to be qualified to meet diagnostic criteria for a diagnosis of ADHD, you have to have had symptoms prior to the age of 12. Now, what does that do? Well, that in many ways expands the possibility. It increases the possible range of individuals who can be diagnosed with ADHD. Now, these ages, 7 to 12, is not really, they're not really arbitrary ages that have been identified. Between those ages, the expectations in school begin to shift pretty significantly. And so it goes from kindergarten and first grade, where we typically expect most kids to have symptoms typically associated with ADHD, to second, third, fourth, and fifth grade, where we're expecting kids by then to really be able to focus and pay attention and sit still and remain in their seat and get their work done without impulsively reacting to things going on around them. So these ages are there because that is the typical times when we start to see children who are developmentally unable to handle the symptoms and behaviors and impulses that are inside them. They're unable to control them at a developmentally appropriate level. Again, the increase in age, or the change from 7 in the DSM-4 to 12 in the DSM-5, allows us to identify other children who may be later in the developmental period of presenting their symptoms. Typically speaking, those that are going to be identified a little bit later are going to be those who are primarily inattentive type. Those who are primarily inattentive type, you know, those are the kids who are daydreamers and they're sitting in the back of the room, but they're not hyperactive and impulsive, so they're really not gaining any attention from anybody. And it very much so is the case that the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So when we think about that perspective, children who are quiet and aren't paying attention and looking out the window and things like that, sure, the teacher recognizes that they're having some problems with their academics perhaps, but they're not creating such a fuss that it's gaining them a lot of attention as far as the behavioral issue. So those kids tend to be diagnosed and identified a little bit later, and so that increasing that age to 12 helps to capture some of those children. Now, another piece that's really important with this age range, this age marker that the DSM has identified, is that, and this is going to be hard for some folks, I know, but is that there really is no such thing as adult onset ADHD. I'm going to pause there because I know that that's going to be difficult for some people, and even some professionals are going to hear that and may disagree with me, and that's okay. But according to our diagnostic manual, the manuals that we use to identify these disorders, there is a requirement that some symptoms causing impairment must be present before the age of 12. As a result, there's no way diagnostically, according to the diagnostic rules, that you can spontaneously begin to have symptoms of what we will really call ADHD at the age of 23 or older, anything over the age of 12, really. So there really is no such thing as adult onset ADHD. What we look for instead is a history of symptoms that look like ADHD. Because here's what happens. Here's what I believe happens. And I think that a lot of other professionals agree with this. Many times we have developed coping strategies, coping skills, ways to manage some of our ADHD symptoms, and we deal with them relatively well during elementary and middle school and high school and on. And we manage those symptoms relatively well because perhaps higher intelligence, perhaps just we had a parent who taught us how to organize ourselves or how to manage those symptoms so that we can get through those periods in our development. So we get through those and symptoms were never identified. We were never known to have symptoms of ADHD. And so here we are getting into a situation where we're reaching college level, sometimes even graduate school. I've evaluated people before who were actually in medical school and had never been evaluated before. And I'm talking to them and it's very clear that they have symptoms associated with ADHD, but there's no history. There's no history of a diagnosis. There's no history of ever being evaluated or looked at as a result of these symptoms. But of course, the person's in medical school. So she was very, very smart. She was very, very academic. She was one of those students who could hear something the first time and immediately catch on and get it and didn't have to study. So all of those skills and stuff that are usually affected by ADHD, she was able to overcome those things because she didn't have to study. She didn't have to reread things. She could, she was intuitive enough to where she could gain the information just from what the teacher was saying in the little bit of time that she paid attention. So we have to look back in time and say, well, what were you like in school? And look for some of those symptoms to see if they were present, even if they weren't really impairing, functionally impairing. Were they there and would they have caused a problem had you not had these other coping strategies and these other coping skills? For example, when I was in third grade, I remember my teacher, I was one of those hyperactive kids and I had a hard time. And as you can tell, those of you who are watching a video of me for the first time, I use my hands a lot and I move a lot when I'm talking. And that's because I really have a hard time sitting still and not moving. So me as a third grader, I moved a lot and I was in you know impulsive and those kinds of things. But I had this wonderful teacher who would send me outside after lunch when my hyperactivity was really too difficult for me to manage. She would send me outside and just have me run. I would run around the school or I would run around the playground just to burn off some of that energy so that I could get back into the classroom and finish off the day. If a student has a teacher who is intuitive enough, who is savvy enough, who is creative enough to identify those types of strategies, simple strategies that can be used to help students overcome some of those difficulties, then we may not ever have any real reports of behavioral issues or attentional issues or anything like that. It doesn't mean that they weren't there. It just means that the teacher employed various strategies that allowed them to overcome those difficulties, or at least allowed a situation where the environment was flexible enough so that those symptoms and behaviors were not impairing. So for those reasons, again, we get into situations where a person can be an adult, perhaps has had symptoms since they were a child, but because the environment worked that the way that it did, there really wasn't an impairment in functioning. And so the person now as an adult, perhaps in college or graduate school, all the skills that they should have learned growing up, all of those skills that they didn't have to worry about because they were smart enough to be able to manage, you know, their elementary, middle, and high school classes. They were smart enough to handle those without having to study, without having to reread material. Now that they're in college, graduate school, and even medical school, those skills aren't quite strong enough. Their intelligence, as great as it is, just isn't great enough to help them overcome and cope with the level of material that they have to master now. You know, there's nothing more challenging, nothing equivalent in middle and high school to studying gross anatomy, for example, in medical school, or studying functional medicine as you progress through medical school and onto and even in graduate school and things like that. So when you can't manage the information that and the expectations of the environment that you're in, that's when those symptoms are going to emerge. It doesn't mean that they weren't there before. It just means that they're just now becoming in a situation where you can't manage them with your traditional or your typical or your historical strategies that you've used in the past. So again, it wasn't that all of a sudden these symptoms began out of nowhere and now you have ADHD when you've never had it before and you're 25 years old. What it means is that the symptoms just weren't impairing. They didn't interfere with your functioning before. And now the skills that you have or that you don't have are really beginning to manifest as a problem. Now, for the most part, ADHD is, not for the most part. Let me rephrase that. ADHD is a disorder that has historically been primarily diagnosed in children, again, between the ages of 6 and 8 or so, and primarily boys. We're starting to expand that now because, again, with the change in the DSM and the identification or the recognition that we could have this situation where we really don't have impairing symptoms until we reach adulthood. But it's also expanding because we're starting to recognize that there are different presentations of ADHD in different children. And so whereas the vast majority of kids in the past were boys who were identified with ADHD, now we're starting to recognize these symptoms in girls a little bit more because it tends to be that girls with ADHD happen to be that predominantly inattentive subtype. They don't necessarily have the hyperactive impulsive symptoms quite as often. Those girls that do have the hyperactive impulsive symptoms, those are the ones that we've always identified. But the ones that we're starting to see as really having been the ones that fell through the cracks in the past, those are the ones who are primarily inattentive type. So we're recognizing that it does cross the gender line a little bit more than we thought in the past. The primary treatment for ADHD is medication. Most physicians prescribe stimulant medications for ADHD, but there are other medications as well. We call them non-stimulants, a very creative name for that. But we also have lots of behavioral strategies, lots of environmental things, lots of parenting things that you can do to sort of tighten up and structure the environment a little bit to help kids with ADHD meet our expectations a little bit more regularly. Now, again, the course that I was talking about earlier is going to go into a lot of detail with all of that, but it's just important to know that for the most part, if you talk to somebody about ADHD, you're really going to be very likely to get a recommendation or a prescription for a stimulant medication. And we'll go into a lot of detail with that in the course. But if you look back at some of our previous podcasts earlier, some of our early podcasts, we talk about ADHD in a little bit more detail. All right, the last thing that I want to mention is that there is a lot of research coming out, and there's a whole section of this in the course that will be available later on, probably within the next month or two, I'm hoping. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that it'll be available in the next couple of months. The course is, there's going to be an entire section on lifestyle and choices as it relates to the treatment of ADHD and really the manifestation of ADHD. There's a lot of research coming out now to suggest that there is a strong relationship between ADHD symptoms and diet, exercise, and sleep, and those kinds of symptoms, or those types of behavioral lifestyle things that connect to some of the ADHD symptoms. There have been lots of case studies that's been coming out over the last few years looking at making shifts and changes in diet that have a profound effect on ADHD symptoms. In fact, some people make a significant change in their diet and the majority of their symptoms really go away. Their symptoms become much more manageable and they don't have to go on medication. They don't have to worry about any of those kinds of treatment modalities. So parents may be able to consider the use of a change in diet, nutritional supplements, and those kinds of things, because again, there's a lot of research coming out about that. And we'll have an entire lesson that focuses on diet and possibly an entire other lesson that's going to focus on nutritional supplements and those kinds of things. So, all right, I think that covers everything that I wanted to mention in this ADHD primer. If you have any questions, please write to us. You can follow us, of course, on Facebook, on Twitter, on everywhere, Instagram, our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. You can follow us, of course, on iTunes to get all of our updated podcasts. And for this podcast, The Mental Breakdown, as well as our other podcasts, the Paideia Education Podcast. And again, you can follow us on and subscribe to our YouTube channel, the Paideia YouTube channel. There is the Mental Breakdown YouTube channel, but we're shifting a lot of that over to Paideia because Paideia is the name of the publishing production company that we're using for our books and for our podcasts and videos and all that kind of stuff, which of course brings us to the books. You know, check out the books that we have available right now on Amazon Kindle. There's the Handbook for Raising an Emotionally Healthy Child, Part 1, Behavior Management. That book is a very good start to looking at one of the three pillars of healthy parenting, and that is understanding appropriate behavior, understanding how behavior and what we should expect from behavior, how that changes with the child as he or she develops from birth through adolescence. Part 2 and Part 3 of the book is going to be coming out hopefully later this summer. The other book is the Elimination Diet Manual, kind of referring back to that diet and nutrition talk that I was mentioning a few moments ago. The Elimination Diet Manual is available on Amazon Kindle and is a great tool for you to learn how to address dietary issues that could be and probably are affecting your physical health as well as your mental health. The stresses that occur in our body when we're eating foods that our body just doesn't respond to very well creates a stress response that elicits anxiety, elicits depressive symptoms, ADHD symptoms, and a host of other behavioral and emotional issues. So we certainly encourage you to check out the Elimination Diet Manual. It's only 99 cents on the Kindle store, and it's a great tool that takes, I think, 32 days, 38 days or something like that to work through and eliminate 7 of the big usual suspects is what we call them, that often causes some of that inflammation and stress in the body. You can eliminate those things and see how your body does from there. It's especially true if you are one who has some gastrointestinal problems, IBS, those kinds of things. Many times psoriasis. If you have those kinds of inflammatory types of physiological symptoms, medical symptoms, you know, that is another clue that perhaps your diet and the things that you're consuming is irritating things and causing some of that stress that's not just affecting your physical body, but perhaps even affecting your mental and emotional state. So I talked a lot more about the Elimination Diet Manual than I was expecting, but definitely check it out. And as well as the parenting book, the Handbook for Raising an Emotionally Healthy Child. So, all right. I appreciate you following us, checking us out on YouTube. Please write a review on iTunes if you get a chance. Share our iTunes and YouTube channel with your friends. We need more people talking about this stuff, and we need to get some really good information out. So, again, until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie. Have a great week, and forget to be afraid.